Nehemiah is an amazing book. In just 13 chapters, we get a very wide selection of different types and styles of writing. Big sections of it are from Nehemiah's private journal, a very intimate, dear diary. There's a roll call of workers on the wall building project in chapter 3. There's an official record of returning people in chapter 7. There's the transcription of a sermon that was delivered by the Levites in chapter 9. There's a legal covenant that the people signed in chapter 10. There's a census of leaders that lived in the rebuilt Jerusalem in chapter 11. And there's a state wall opening ceremony recorded in chapter 12, an event the like of which the city had not seen for many years. Significant to the extent that it was their version of the royal wedding. That's how big it was. Nehemiah's writings are full of honesty, revelation, intrigue, and conflict. This book has bust-ups to rival the most explosive of our modern soap operas, and Nehemiah foils dastardly plans of sabotage that wouldn't look out of place in the latest action thriller movies. It's a fantastic read. When you read this book, especially when you read it in big chunks, and I only read you a small part of it this morning, take time to read the book. You can read it in about an hour from beginning to end, about the time of a TV program that you might watch. When you read it in big chunks, when you let the weight of it penetrate you, when you soak up the almost countless names and historical records that are meticulously recited for us, it speaks strongly of the authenticity of the writing. Who on earth, in his right mind, if he was making this book up, would break the action sequences, the double crossing and the intrigue with these so-called boring lists of names? Who would have the imagination to make up these census records? Clearly, this book stands as a beacon of authenticity, validating the Old Testament as an accurate historical record of life 2,500 years ago, faithfully recorded for us by this man of God, and divinely preserved for us over the years as a testimony to God's goodness as he dealt with his ancient chosen people. But look, it's not just the internal evidence of the text which we base our view on. Archaeological evidence has been uncovered, which also explicitly identifies at least two of the three enemies that Nehemiah faced. Ancient records show that these people, the people that opposed Nehemiah, were influential people. They were the rulers under the Persians of the surrounding territories, Samaria to the north, Ammon east of Jordan, and Arabia, which stretched in those days, covering the area southeast of Judea, across Sinai, all the way to Egypt. And that's been authenticated by historical archaeological records. The book of Nehemiah is shown to reflect accurately the political setup of its time. So, when we read it in the 21st century, we can have great confidence that we are reading real history preserved for us by God's almighty hand. But is it just accurate history and great drama? How relevant is it? It's a great story, but how relevant is it? After all, it was written 2,500 years ago in a land that's 2,500 miles away from us. What possible relevance can it have to 21st century Shepshed? Well, let me paraphrase the book's message that I've read to you this morning like this. A small group of believers in the living God are called out of a pagan society to form a community together. They labour in a God-honouring task that seems beyond their limited resources. A ragbag band of different personalities and skills they are faced by secular enemies all around that are intent on destroying the work and shaming them into submission. They trust God to provide for their safety and success, and against all the odds, they ultimately win the battle and defeat and shame their despondent enemies as God gives them the ultimate blessing and victory. Did you spot any parallels in the way that I described Nehemiah there? I hope you did. See, as New Testament Christians, we read the Old Testament with different eyes than the original Jewish readers read it. In fact, the New Testament, as it deals with much of the Old Testament, reinterprets God's unfolding story in fascinating ways. So I want this morning for us to read again Nehemiah through New Testament eyes and see what we can learn. Now, I've got 4 points for you this morning: the people, the burden, the task, and the result. The people, the burden, the task, and the result. So let's begin with the people. Who were these people? Well, right at the very beginning of what I read to you in Nehemiah chapter 1, the first verses, the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. Nehemiah was one of God's chosen people, even though he was many, many miles away, east in Babylon, in Susa, the winter capital of the Persian kings. God had visited terrible judgment on his chosen people of Israel, of Judah. And because of their sins, because of their refusal to follow him, he had carried them away into exile in Babylon. But nevertheless, true to his word, true to his prophetic word, he preserved his people, and after 70 years, he brought some of them back out of exile and back to Jerusalem. God preserved a remnant of his people through which he fulfilled his eternal promises to eventually deliver the Messiah, the Son of David, to his people. And therefore, in truth, that physical preservation of the Jewish nation is not just confined to the Old Testament, but God, in a very real sense, is preserving his remnant today. And we, if we are believers today, we too are also part of that remnant, part of that spiritual Israel, who have entered into that spiritual Israel because we are the true sons of Abraham. We believe and have faith, and so we have become spiritual Israel. And we too, as a remnant, we live in a Babylon that is heathen and largely hostile to God's people, just like Nehemiah did. In fact, it's getting harder and harder to live in our day of Babylon, isn't it? Increasingly, the laws of our land are removing our Christian liberty. They're dictating that we can't run our bed and breakfast according to our Christian principles, or they're preventing us from expressing our religion in our workplaces, even when this is as innocuous as wearing a cross or offering to pray for others. And our enemies are abounding, aren't they? The new atheists have rallied behind their militant leader, Richard Dawkins, and they seem intent on cleansing our society of all the religious influence. Do you worry about where else he's going? Fear not. Despite appearances to the contrary, God's remnant will survive. God has a purpose and a plan, and he will keep his people. In Nehemiah's words, the good hand of our God is upon us. Now, it might get very difficult for us in the future. Christianity might be all but wiped out from our land. But God will preserve his people. Keep the faith. Trust in the one who has written the plan. Draw encouragement from Nehemiah's record of the faithfulness of his God to a remnant people. But maybe you're not one of God's people today. Perhaps you're not a Christian at all. Perhaps you're quite happy with that situation of not being one of God's people. Well, if that's you this morning, please don't be fooled. God has said that those who live this life for themselves, well, they will ultimately lose their lives. Far better to be one of God's remnant people now and enjoy the blessings of all eternity afterwards. The people, the remnant people of God. Two, the burden. How does Nehemiah respond to the news of the problems in Jerusalem? Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? See, Nehemiah didn't just get a bright idea one day. I know. I'll ask the king if I can go and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Seems like a great project. How does he go from being cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, which is a pretty influential and powerful position? How did he go from being cupbearer to the king to being governor of Jerusalem? He didn't go down the job centre and fill out an application form. No, there's a clear chain of events occurring here, and I want to show you this chain. And there are four parts to the chain. The news is followed by sorrow. The sorrow is followed by prayer. And the prayer leads to opportunity. News leads to sorrow. Sorrow leads to prayer. And prayer leads to opportunity. So let's look at the news. Nehemiah learns of the fate of Jerusalem when Hanani, his fellow Jew, visits Susa. But look, the action isn't all on Hanani. He doesn't come and broadcast the news into the streets of Susa. Verse 2 of chapter 1 tells us that Nehemiah questioned Hanani and the men who came with him. Nehemiah questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. He went to seek him out. There's a man from Jerusalem coming to town. I must go and find out, says Nehemiah. And he gets up and it would have been easy for him to be all consumed with his task of being cupbearer to the king. But no, he goes out of his way to seek out Hanani. He's interested in both the status of his people and the condition of the ancient city. So, let me ask you this morning. Are you proactive in discovering news of Christian work in other places? Do you take opportunity to inform yourselves of the work of other churches, the work of God, the work of Christian charities, the work of missionaries abroad? Do you contact other Christians? In short, are you proactive in finding out about God's kingdom? Or are you happy in your corner, watching your telly and preoccupied with your secular pleasures? We live in a digitally connected world. See, unlike Nehemiah, you don't have to wait until others travel to your city before you can find out about God's work at a distance. You don't need me to drive all the way down from West Yorkshire to tell you about the work of Hope Church Huddersfield. If you've got an interweb near you, you can go www.hopechurchhd.org and you can read all about it. Put yourselves on the Christian Institute mailing list. Get a Missionary Society's regular mailing. Email a missionary. Take out a subscription to Evangelicals Now. Keep yourself informed about gospel work. Take an interest in what God is doing in this world. Find out the news. That's the first step. Without the news, you're not going to get a burden. News leads to sorrow. The news Nehemiah got wasn't very good, was it? Look at verse 3. those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and the gates have been burned with fire. It's a mess. Not all of the news you hear about Christian work will be bad news. You haven't heard bad news about Huddersfield this morning. But lots of it will be concerning, because we stand for very different things than the world that we live in. So there will be much that you learn about that should give you concern, just like it did to Nehemiah. Look at Nehemiah's reaction in verse 4. When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. See, Nehemiah's sorrow, and that's an appropriate response when you hear of bad news, but Nehemiah's sorrow isn't without hope. It isn't hand-wringing, heart-wrenching melancholy, a despair that's empty of any optimism about the future. That's not the right response for followers of the living God, is it? Reactions like that are for those who live without God and without hope in this world. Don't react to bad news like that. Nehemiah didn't. His sorrow drove him instead to prayer. News leads to sorrow, leads to prayer. Nehemiah prayed. Now, just look at this prayer with me in chapter 1 of Nehemiah. It's recorded for us at some length between verses 5 and 10. It's very, very informative. Nehemiah reminded God of his promises, ancient promises. Nehemiah confessed his own and his nation's sins. He prayed with his Bible open in front of him. Huge sections of Deuteronomy 7, 9 and 28 and Leviticus 26 and Exodus are all quoted in Nehemiah's prayer. Nehemiah's prayer has structure. It has a focus on a specific outcome. It has persistence. If you don't know your Jewish months, Nehemiah prayed like this for 4 months before he got his opportunity with the king. So let me ask you, do you pray like this? Could you pray like this? Will you pray like this? Could Nehemiah teach you how to pray like this? I hope the answer to some of those questions will be yes for you in the coming weeks. Learn to pray like Nehemiah prayed. Because when you pray like this, God causes things to happen. The news led to sorrow, led to prayer, and the prayer led to opportunity. Chapter 2 opens with Nehemiah serving wine in the king's presence, and the king asks Nehemiah why he's sad. Did you notice what the text says next? Very much afraid, but plucking up courage, because this is what he prayed for, Nehemiah reveals the reason for his sadness. Do you know what? I'm really, really comforted that Nehemiah was very much afraid. I know that he was speaking to the king, and we in our everyday lives don't often speak to kings, do we? But still, let's be honest, it's a scary thing, isn't it, to confess your Christian values and lifestyle to others, or at least it can be scary. I'm comforted that Nehemiah didn't find it easy to speak, because I don't always find it easy to speak, and I guess you don't either. But inspired by prayer and with a heart burdened by the right motives, Nehemiah does speak up. And even though we are afraid, we too must speak up for God and his values and his concerns. We must do it gently and we must do it politely, but we must speak up. And when Nehemiah did speak up, What an amazing answer to his prayer. What an amazing opportunity. The king said to me, what is it that you want? Here, this great God-given opportunity for Nehemiah to serve. And following his famous arrow prayer of verse 4, which we would do well to often copy in our own lives, Nehemiah commits himself to the opportunity that God has brought for him. Now, your opportunities will be different. Don't imagine somebody's going to ask you to go and rebuild an ancient wall. But your opportunities will be gospel opportunities, gospel tasks. If you proactively seek out news of God's kingdom, you will grow in your sorrowful, prayerful burden for that work. And that will, I promise you, if you pray about it, it will lead to opportunities for gospel service in your life. The task. Point two, the task. Sorry, point two, the burden. Point three, the task. We've seen the people, we've seen the burden, and we've seen the task. Point three. Here is Nehemiah saying to the king, I want to go and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So off he goes. Goes and he surveys the broken down ruins. And in chapter 2 and verse 17, he says to the people, you've seen the trouble we're in. You've seen that Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls. I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king has said to me. And they replied, let's start rebuilding. I'm not quite sure how many of you here this morning are stonemasons or brickies. Probably not too many of us, I don't think. But you know what? Doesn't matter. Unlike the people of Nehemiah's day, you're not being called to build a physical city. You are being called to build a spiritual city. Fortunately for us, the principles are exactly the same. And so we can still learn from Nehemiah. Because facing the task of building the walls, they had two challenges. Two challenges. The first was an internal challenge, and the second was an external challenge. So when you're facing the task of building a spiritual city, you're going to face the same two challenges. Plenty of others too, but two from here. The internal challenge. We didn't read very much of it, and there's lots of it, but chapter 3 is the roll call of the people who built the wall. Chapter 3 is amazing. It seems boring when you first read it, this list of all these people and which bits of it they did and how far they did and what they did, and it repeats itself. But actually it's great. Chapter 3 is fantastic because it's a systematic approach. They had a plan and everybody did their part. And it lists all the different kinds of people that did the work. All sorts of different people worked shoulder to shoulder in the work, regardless of their status. Well, most of them did anyway. The nobles of Tekoa in verse 5, well, they were too proud to get involved. And they earned themselves the shame of being recorded as shirkers for centuries to come. Anyway, the picture is clear, isn't it? Gospel work is a team effort. There's no such thing as a solo Christian. Honestly, we are called to work in teams. You each have a contribution to the work. There's a gap in the work if you stop your Christian service. So let me ask you, which is your part of the work? Which bit are you skilled for? When they were building the wall, some laid stones, others crafted wooden gates, still others worked with hinges, and some others were roofers. Your particular God-given skills make you suited to a particular task in God's church? Are you contributing your part to the work party? Or are you a spiritual Tekoan, shirking your responsibilities? It's time to put our personality differences and our pride onto one side and to get stuck into the gospel work, hard and arduous though it is. So that's the internal challenge they faced when they were looking at the task of building the wall. Here's the external challenge. The external challenge. When you do gospel work for God, be that building a wall or building a church, you face opposition from those around you. Nehemiah did, you will too. The opposition will come in different forms, just like it did for Nehemiah. Some of it will be vocal and some of it will be violent. Do you remember what I read to you? Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall. He became angry. What are those feeble Jews doing, he said. Will they restore the wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Can they bring those stones back to life? And his mate standing by his side. It's easy to be bold when you've got a powerful person next to you, isn't it? Tobiah the Ammonite by his side said, look at what they're building. Even if a fox climbs up on it, it's going to break down. They were mocking them. You will get vocal opposition. You'll also get violent opposition. Sanballat, Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the men of Ashdod heard that the repairs of Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, and they were angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem. So here's a military response. Your opposition to the work will be vocal and it will be violent. In Dewsbury, when we put a Christian text in Urdu on our church notice board, some people came in the night and removed the notice board. Sawed it off at the legs. Because they didn't like what we were doing. You will get violent opposition. How did Nehemiah respond to this verbal and violent opposition? How must we respond when we are abused and threatened with violence against our gospel work? Well, Nehemiah responded prayerfully and practically. He responded prayerfully and practically. Look at verse 4 of chapter 2. Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Look at verse 9. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Now, I hope praying is an obvious response. Because Christians, they pray, don't they? And I hope it will be your first response when you meet opposition to your work, just like it was for Nehemiah. But look, don't just pray. Be wise and be practical as well. Make your response prayerful and practical. When they were threatened with the violence, the people posted a guard day and night. And then, we didn't read it, but in chapter 4 and verse 13, we hear that Nehemiah stationed some of the people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by their families with their swords, spears and bows to protect the work. The people prayed, but they also helped themselves. They acted wisely with their resources and the intelligence that God had given them. So use the same pattern today. Pray, and then act wisely in defense of your God-given gospel work. And look, be concerned about the opposition to gospel work in other places. Today, we fight less with swords and spears and bows. We fight more with lawyers and courts and money. So, pray for the work of the Christian Institute and send them £20 now and again for their legal defence fund. Who knows when you might need it? It's ever so easy. You can do it on the phone or on the internet if you've got a debit or a credit card. It only takes 3 minutes. Pray and be practical in your opposition to gospel work. With God's help, Nehemiah repelled his opponents. The enemy was frustrated, and the people returned to their building work. And they continued with the building, mindful of the opposition they had received, guarding their work. So don't be cowed into submission by opposition. Repel it with prayer and with practical work. Time prevents us from exploring the other examples of opposition that Nehemiah faced. But if you want to read more about it, chapter 6 is full of more things that went wrong and more ways that they opposed them and more things that Nehemiah did to repel the opposition. So, my time is gone. We've seen four things. We've seen the people, we've seen the burden, we've seen the task, and finally, the result. What was the result? Wow. We are the same people. We are the people who are building a spiritual Jerusalem. We are the remnant of God. We need the same burden from God to be about His task. And we need to pray and grow that burden and see God direct us just as He directed Nehemiah into a providential opportunity. In our gospel task, we face the same challenges of working together, the internal challenges, and we face opposition, the external challenges. But look, you are promised exactly the same result that Nehemiah achieved. Look at verse 15 of chapter 6. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. It was achieved because God had helped them. God will help you too as you seek to build His kingdom in Shepshed. When we do gospel work, we work not for this world, but we work for eternity. There is a great building project underway, the likes of which have never been attempted before. The successful outcome is guaranteed. You are on the winning side. God is at work. Will you be one of His people? Will you share the burden? Will you join in with the task? There are crowns of righteousness for the builders. Will you stand among the wall builders of Jerusalem in that great day?